The popularity of natural wine has exploded in the last several years, especially here in Oregon. But does it actually deserve all that hype, or is it just another trend? Orange wine, I'm looking at you. On Thursdays, we talk food here on CityCast Portland, and today our host Claudia Meza is talking with Brent Braun, sommelier at OK Omens. They are a National James Beard Award semifinalist for Outstanding Wine Program this year. He's going to be talking about the roots of natural wine and why he thinks that Oregon might have some of the best natural wine in the country. It's Thursday, March 9th. I'm John Natariani, and this is what Portland's talking about.
So, Brent, first question, just straight off. Is natural wine over?
Oh, is natural wine over? No, natural wine's not over. Natural wine's been around for a long time, and it's not going anywhere. If anything, it's only gaining in popularity as a kind of, as it gains more mass appeal and as more people start to get a gist of what it is and what it means.
You know, I was reading up on the trends, and someone compared it, and I just love this comparison, to grunge in the 90s. But grunge did not last. But you're saying that natural wine has always been around. It's basically one of the oldest ways of making wine. So the only thing that's new are all the people just sort of like, I don't know, getting hip to it.
Yeah, because I think, you know, when you think about it, all wine was essentially made naturally until, I guess, around World War II, when we started inventing a lot of chemicals for farming and winemaking. And so really, natural wine is a throwback to the way things were done. And the wine that has been made conventionally since, we'll call it again, the 1950s until, I mean, it's still being made, that's more the blip on the radar, if anything. Wines made like that kind of tend to lack a little bit of soul. And so we're just bringing the soul back, you know?
For those who are just like, I still don't get it. What do we mean by natural wine? I mean, you just laid out, you know, not using pesticides, which I always thought was just organic wines.
Totally. So I think the best way to get someone's head around this is, first off, you can divide natural wine almost into two things. You can divide it into the wine itself, and you can divide it into the wine culture surrounding it. We'll start with the wine side of it. And then within that, you're broken down into two categories, into the viticulture side, aka the farming of the grapes, and then the winemaking side of it. As far as the farming of the grapes, the idea in natural winemaking would be no pesticides, no herbicides, no big chemical interventions in the vineyard. I think a big one for a lot of us ends up being just like no glyphosate. Glyphosate is, it is a known carcinogenic, whatever. And it's used in vineyards still. We use it for a lot of things still, and it's ridiculous. So that's like the vineyard side of it. If you're farming like that, your grapes should have native yeast populations on them because you didn't blast the yeast away with chemicals, which means that you can take those grapes into a winery and they'll start off natural fermentation. So you don't have to add cultured yeast, or you don't have to add yeast that were created in a lab. And so this would be part of the natural
Gotcha.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, so it really all ties in. You know, one thing leads to another. You have a lot of these winemakers in France who've talked about how when they tried to move their winemaking to not adding yeast and to not adding additions and to not messing around with it, they found that it didn't work until they fixed the way they farmed. Because if you bring in unhealthy grapes, you're not going to be able to make wines without a bunch of manipulations in the cellar. It's just not going to turn out very well.
So something about Oregon's wine country, it's special. But I think a lot of people don't know exactly why. And so I always thought it was the culture. Like, what's so special about this region?
Right. I mean, in some ways, it just kind of fits the Oregon ethos in general. I mean, we're not that uptight of a culture. Also, the wine, the current wine industry, which was, you know, birthed in the 1960s, it's fairly young. So there's not that, like, as long of a precedent of it being here. And I think Oregon's always had this kind of sense of being an underdog, which helps, you know, when when you're an underdog, you kind of, everyone's banding together. Everyone wants to be on the same page. There's always been this kind of culture, you know, long before I was around, of course, of sharing information, sharing equipment.
Right.
And I think that's continued to this day into the natural wine culture. I mean, so many of the smaller natural or natural focused or natural leaning wineries are all in communication with each other all the time. when that's like the baseline of what's established, if you're new and you find out that everyone else is like that, then you end up being like that too. And you're like, okay, this is how we do this. We share information, yeah. We share what we've learned. And it just kind of self-perpetuates itself.
And what about the wine itself? Like, what is so special about our region?
We have a great, great area for growing grapes. There's no question about that at this point. You know, the exposures are right. The growing climate is different than, you know, Burgundy, which is what we're always emulating, but it's similar enough that it kind of gets us where we need to go. And I, as much as anything, it's just a lot of human passion over the last 40 years to prove that this is a world-class wine region, and it clearly is.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the region in general. The natural wine scene itself has had very large growth in the last 10 years or so. So what do you think the most significant change has been?
I think there's a couple factors that have really been in Oregon's favor. I think the first one is a proximity to Portland. When you have a city, you're just exposed to new things all the time, and that trickles into the wine region. And so I think having Portland right here is really important. And then also, it's affordable to still buy, well, not so much to buy land, but to buy grapes here. Unlike somewhere like Napa, where, you know, great Napa fruit, the high-end Napa fruit might be $10,000 a ton, which is insane. Where in Oregon, you still have access to affordable grapes, and it gives young people room to experiment, because if the buy-in is only $1,500, $2,000 for a ton of grapes, you can afford to like save up that money and be like, I'm going to take a flyer on my first ton of grapes. And if it comes out great, then you can start a business, and all of a sudden you can start being a winemaker, you know?
Coming up after a quick break, we're going to take a look at how the culture of drinking wine has changed in the last several years.
And Portland wine culture itself, even since I've been here for like nearly 20 years, it's changed a lot.
I mean, the fact that
wine bars are becoming more approachable, like they don't feel as like snooty, you know?
Yeah, no, that shift is so fun in Portland. And it really, so you think about the wine bars of the kind of 90s and early 2000s, and, you know, they were called like Sip and Taste and, you know, things like that. And it was always, you know, I always call them like wine bars for your mom type, like generation of wine bars. Yeah, like that shift into kind of the current wave of wine bars, I think about in around, you know, 2018 or so, when we opened OK Omens, that movement was happening all around the city, where a lot of us had been to Europe. We'd seen the wine bar, the natural wine bar culture happening in London and Paris. And we were like, we need that here. Like, we need to have casual places for people to drink wine, drink interesting wine, and to kind of help build what in some ways feels like a youth culture of like young people choosing to come drink natural wine instead of going to a dive bar or instead of going to a cocktail bar. The late night part didn't work out so well. Almost none of us made it as late night places, because organically farmed fruit is still kind of expensive, and it still costs more to drink that wine than it does to drink, you know, cheap whiskey and cheap beer at a dive bar.
Wait, could it be, and I'm just like, you would know a lot more than me, of course, but could it be that when you don't really need any kind of food to open up a wine bar, as opposed to like a bar? Because I go to my local wine bar, and at a certain point, I have to go to Slim's because I need to eat. Do you know what
I
mean?
Yeah, like, yeah.
And then there's only so many tins and little crackers that you can have, and it's not going to satiate like dinner. Since you've become a restaurant, has anything changed? Do you think people stay longer? Or
We stopped right before COVID. We cut our hours down. I think we were open till 12 originally, and then we moved to 11, and then with COVID and the shift to being a restaurant, you know, we close at 10 now. But nonetheless, to your point, if you had somewhere that looked like, let's say that looked like Bar Norman, which, have you been into Bar Norman?
I don't think so.
Okay,
no.
I mean, it's
where's that at?
Kind of that little area where like Lemoule and Clinton Street Theater are. But
so in the Clinton neighborhood,
yeah. You go in and it's so charming, and again, so classic. It has such a classic Parisian wine bar feel to it in a way. And yeah, to your point, if a place like that was able to have like a full dinner menu, you know, what would that mean for late night? I, it's hard to say. I mean, it really complicates everything though, because from a, you know, just from a financial perspective of then you have, I mean, you have a kitchen and things break in kitchens, and you have food and food wastage, and you have to hire cooks, and it definitely makes it a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
And I really think that the monetary aspect is a big part of it, of just the buy-in's a lot higher. And so.
Yeah. So one of the reasons we also brought you up, Brent, is that a bit ago, I was talking to Brooke from Eater, And I kind of gave a hot, I do a lot of hot takes. Sometimes they land. And this one did not land with Brooke. And I told her, I was like, you know what? I think that orange wine might be a little overrated. And she just like really was like, like she was, she clutched pearls.
Yeah, Brooke and her pearls, always those pearls around her neck, right? The giant pearls.
But I wanted to talk to you about orange wine specifically, because my whole thing is just like, well, it, the way it was being treated, like, oh, orange wine, I'm just like, it's literally just the skins. They're leaving the skins on. Like, what? So why are you guys freaking out? Because I remember that was the feeling I had when orange wine came out, like, oh, you don't know orange wine. And I feel like orange wine was the natural wine, and now natural wine. Now there's natural orange wine, which to me, I'm just like, oh, okay, well then.
So, okay, so I'm, there's kind of a lot embedded in that. So,
I get that a lot.
Yeah, I think
there's a lot here embedded.
If you don't mind, I'll do just a 1 minute on what orange wine is in case anyone's kind of like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yes,
not made from oranges, which we is still a really common question. We get it, you know, at the restaurant. So, or the best way to think about orange wine is that it's kind of the sibling cousin or something to rosé, where if you think about rosé, which everybody at least has heard of rosé, with rosé, you're taking red grapes and you're basically making them like white wine. With orange wine, you're taking white grapes and you're making them more like red wine. So this kind of flipping. So you take these white grapes, which usually with white grapes, you would just, again, like squeeze the juice out of as a simplification, and you crush them, you macerate them, with their stems, like you, and their skins, like you would with a red wine. And the end result is going to be a wine that has picked up this kind of amber or orange or pink hue from the color of whatever it can pull from those white grape skins. And so I think part of the, you know, we'll call it hype or whatever, it was just that it felt like a new category. And coming off of like the 5 year, 6 year craze of people being so rabid for rosé, it was like, well, this is just something new to be excited about. And it brought a lot of people into wine, which I appreciate. It's oftentimes orange wines or skin contact wines, whatever you want to call them, can have a more combination of like savory and fruity. And so I think a lot of people who maybe thought rosé wines were a little like insipid or just fruit juice were like, hey, this is cool. There's some like spice and earth to this refreshing beverage as well. Yeah. It opened the door to a lot of drinkers. And thus, you know, as happens, a lot of winemakers started being like, well, shoot, I need to make an orange wine because like this stuff is flying right now. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like peak orange wine has kind of like crested, if you will. Like,
and that's what I'm saying. And that's what I was talking about.
Orange wine's not going anywhere. It is, again, this is a very historic style of winemaking. And like anything, there's a spectrum from like quick maceration, chug by the river orange wines, and hopefully you're paying $20-25 a bottle for that stuff, to like long maceration, serious wines that have, again, the structure of great red wines coming from great fruit sources that like they belong on the dinner table with the in the best restaurants. And those ones are going to be a lot more expensive. And so my point is to say that the category is not going anywhere, and it shouldn't. It's an important category, and there's a lot of delicious things to be drunk within that category.
And now for your microdose of news. A local law firm is planning to file more than a dozen lawsuits on behalf of Black shoppers alleging racial profiling at Portland area chain stores. One notable story from Willamette Week, a 32-year-old creative director at the ad agency Wyden and Kennedy says a security guard accused her of shoplifting and threatened to call the police after she bought 3 lipsticks at Sephora in January. And apparently, Republicans can still win big points by bashing Portland, no matter what the facts might be. A number of Walmarts announced recently that they were closing here in the city. And earlier this week, Texas Governor Greg Abbott took a shot at us on Twitter. He said, quote, "This is what happens when cities refuse to enforce the rule of law. It allows the mob to take over." Of course, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler fired back. He pointed out that retail theft is a national issue and that dozens of Walmarts have closed in recent years in the state of Texas. For more local news and events, sign up for our daily newsletter, Hey Portland. We'll throw a link in the show notes. Well, that's all for today here on CityCast Portland. If you enjoyed the show, you should tell a friend about it, rate us, or leave us a review. I'm John Natariani, in for Claudia Meza. We'll be back with more news from around the city tomorrow morning. Until then, maybe I'll see you at Slim's.